Hello, I'm Michael Bott.
And I'm Rupert Soskin. And welcome to another Prehistory Guys interview.
You know what, Rupert? I love archaeology. I think we both love archaeology, don't we?
We do.
We love all the data. We love all the analysis. We love all the detail, you know, that stuff that comes from professional archaeology digs and so on and so forth. And we love all that fleshing out of the people. But, I mean, the whole thing we started off with, you know, was just loving being with the stones themselves. I don't think there'd be a Standing with Stones film if it hadn't been for that thing of the mystery of standing in a field with a standing stone.
It's very true. It's very true. There is a distinct relationship that you can have with any site you visit. It's true.
So the fact is, we don't have any problem at all with talking to people who just do that, who just love the stones for themselves.
Yes. It's in fact, do you know what? I think it's actually an important thing, because a lot of the time we're talking to archaeologists who are busy working in the field, as you said, you know, whether it's digging stuff up or laboratory work, we're painstakingly extracting information from all sorts of things. But it is important that we also talk to people who just have that passion and relationship with the sites themselves. It's true.
So it is with deep joy, deep pleasure, that we can introduce to you Elizabeth Dale. Elizabeth Dale writes a fantastic blog called The Cornish Bird.
Do you know what? I love Liz's work. The way she gets into the spirit of, whether it's the history or the legends or whatever, she writes so beautifully about the sites. And recommend her blog to anybody. She started doing podcasts as well, and so it's a treat to get her on. She's actually, you can trace her family. She can trace her family in Cornwall back as far as 1550, which that's astonishing, isn't it? 500 years in
Cornwall.
Gives
her a certain sense of authority, I think, about yes. subject matter in hand,
yes. know,
which is which is Cornwall, not only one of our favourite places, but, you know, one of the, if you want to trip over standing stones and stone circles all day, it's the place to go, really.
Yes, absolutely.
So, yeah, we had a great conversation with Lizzie about prehistoric stuff and Cornwall. I think we'd just better get on with it and hope you enjoy the conversation.
Let's do that thing.
So, Elizabeth Dale, Cornish Bird, welcome
Hello.
To the Prehistory Guys podcast. How's life in Cornwall this moment?
Hello. It's very nice, thank you. And thank you so much for having me.
It's okay. A great pleasure. We like
Huge
what you
pleasure.
Do.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. That's very kind.
I think a lot of people.
That's very kind.
I think a lot of people like what you do as well.
I hope so.
Yeah, yeah. But your heritage, as it were, in Cornwall goes back quite a long way. Can you
I've
a
got
bit
some
about
creds
how
there,
far back
you know.
It goes? Yeah,
yeah. It's quite important in Cornwall as well to have those creds. I did some research into my family tree about 10 years ago now, basically because my father was interested. He comes from a farming family. And he just was interested to, you know, he knew his family history back a couple of generations, but he didn't really know where anybody was from, you know, sort of any further back. So I did some research for him and was able to trace back to 1550, which was made much easier by the fact that farmers don't tend to move anywhere. they're sort of, you know, quite static. They yeah. stay in one place, and we were able to trace them quite easily, actually, back to 1550, where the records then start to dwindle quite significantly, yeah. the written records.
Yeah. So you've actually been a farming family for nearly 500 years.
Yeah,
That's
yeah.
amazing.
There was the odd baker in there.
Okay.
Okay.
Couple of generations of bakers. but 90% of them were farming families, and actually down in Penwith, which was a happy coincidence for both me and my father, because we both love that area. And I'd always felt strangely sort of at home there, connected, I don't know. And so it was lovely to actually establish the fact that the family had lived almost continuously on the same sort of few farms near Zena for several generations, until about, I think, about 1860, 1870, when they moved up more towards Falmouth, which is where we are now.
Before we move on to some of the other stuff, you were talking about your father there, and because his attachment to the land was very influential on you as well, wasn't it?
Very much so, very much so. Yeah, I mean, he is the reason that I'm interested in ancient history, I suppose. He went and visited Stonehenge for the first time, I think, when he was quite a young man, in the maybe the late 50s, early 60s, and was absolutely blown away by it, but in a very, very farmer type way, in that he wanted to work out how they moved them, you know. He because he's such a practical person, and he's worked physically his whole life, the idea of how man was able to maneuver those enormous pieces of stone just, you know, befuddled him, started his interest. And then he started looking into, obviously, sites that were closer to home. And you know, when we were kids, if we ever had any time off, we didn't go, you know, beaching or anywhere like that. We would be taken off in the car with a picnic and up onto Dartmoor or onto Bodmin Moor or down onto the Penwith, just looking to find a great big bit of rock. That my dad would then measure to see how heavy it was and try and work out how anybody moved it, you know. And that's, I think, where my interest sprang from, was from through him, really.
Yeah, but it went a bit further than that, didn't it? It went a bit further than just looking at them.
Yes, yeah, you're talking about his own personal standing stone. Yes, yeah. So for the millennium, he decided he wanted to mark it in some kind of way. And so he went round to local quarries looking for the perfect stone. Couldn't be any old stone. Uh-oh. It had to be just the right, you know, the right size and the right shape. And he wanted one that had no signs of machine cutting or any kind of like drilling in it or anything like that. He wanted a natural piece of stone, and eventually found this enormous rock, to which my mother went, "What do you think you're going to do with that?" And of course, what he did do was, you know, dug a big hole on the top of our farm and erected his own standing stone, which
How in the order of stone sizes in the whole of Cornwall, where do you reckon your dad's standing stone?
It's pretty hefty. We were actually only talking about it a day or two ago, because during lockdown, been very fortunate that I've been able to have the farm to roam around on, and I happened to say to him that I thought like a rabbit would dug a massive hole at the base of his stone, you know. We're just talking about it, and he actually mentioned then that he sunk it too deep. He actually put 4 foot of the stone into the ground. Right. So there's at least there's at least, I would estimate, 8 or 9 foot above ground. And he sunk it, he thinks now, too deep in the ground, because he was like, it could have been higher. But he was worried about it falling over and, you know, squashing someone.
Do you know what? I don't doubt that's a conversation that took place in the Neolithic.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm pretty sure
it is. Almost guaranteed, isn't it?
Almost guaranteed. Yeah. Well, somebody went and looked at it and went, "Oh, I thought you were going to put it the other way around."
So, Lizzie, what got you into writing?
I don't know. I mean, if you want to go way back, I remember writing short stories when I was at school, when I was quite young, you know, sort of seven or 8 years old. And I remember You probably don't want to, not interested in this at all, but I wrote a story about mermaids. I mean, so Cornish, isn't it? I wrote a story about mermaids, and my primary school teacher was obviously impressed with this, and he read it to the rest of the class. And it wasn't as part of any lesson that we were doing. I'd just written it. Mm. And that feeling of having something that you had invented and written, read out to other people and held up as being good. I always remember that. And whether that's where it sprung from or not, I don't know. But I've always written, but it wasn't until quite recently that I started actually taking it seriously. I went back to university when I was 38, 4 years, and I must be 37. So as a mature student, I went back and studied.
But by that time, you'd travelled quite a bit throughout the world.
I'd spent about 10 years working and travelling abroad with my other half. It was a fantastic time for me. I learned an awful lot as a girl who, previous to that, had, you know, bimbled around Cornwall for most of her life until I was like 22. And then I met this chap that I fell in love with, who has ants in his pants to this day. And so we were just constantly traveling and working wherever we could, doing whatever we could.
So what was the order of things then? Because, you write about Cornwall in the broadest sense. You don't just write about the prehistorical aspects. Of it, and obviously that's what our listeners are predominantly interested in. But but you know, it's important to note that, you know, you're looking at all sorts of aspects of Cornwall, including later history as well. But I'm just trying to join the dots here, because you, in your travels, you visited prehistoric sites in different places. So obviously, you know, that influence of your father in your childhood, kind of set the bug going for prehistoric things. But, you know, particularly when people are travelling to places, all manner of countries in Africa, you know, that actually some of the prehistoric sites are not what people seek out. So many of them are not easy to get to. So it was that, you know, whether it was an accidental thing or a deliberate thing, and, you know, how did it feature in your travels?
No, it was very much a deliberate thing, because it was something that I was always interested in. I think that I should make it clear that, you know, me and my partner, we're not well off. So we would travel in the cheapest ways possible and stay in the cheapest hotels that we could find, eat local food, travel on local transport. Mm-hmm. And when we visited a country, we didn't visit for a couple of weeks. We would visit for much longer periods of time, you know, as long as we wanted, in a way. We would quite often go somewhere with no firm date of when we were leaving. So we would just explore however much we wanted to. And, you know, I was always the one that was reading about some random place, you know, or I'd hear some random story. And because we weren't on any tight schedule, we would take the time to go and find those places, to go and hunt them down. Which is what happened with the stone circles out in Gambia. I've actually been to Gambia a couple of times. I think I'm right in saying that it was the second time that we went there that we went to find the stone circles. And that time we actually were travelling overland. We'd gone from Spain into Morocco, Morocco to Mauritania, and then just basically down through, and we ended up then several months in the region, going through Mauritania and Mali and Burkina Faso and Senegal and Gambia. And the circles were just something that I had read about and wanted to see. So,
And did you take anything away from that experience, those? Any sense of, I mean, there is, I don't know if there was any folk memory or anything like that.
No,
because they're relatively recent, those stones.
Yeah,
although they span quite a broad period, they're relatively recent, aren't they?
Yeah. As far as I could gather from talking to anyone there at the time, no one had any clue why they were there or what they were for. And we didn't, we saw several different circles, some of them quite small, quite sort of compact, you know, the stones were very tight to each other.
Yeah.
But there didn't seem to be any sort of folklore about who had put them there and why, not that I established anyway. But I said to you before, I was, what struck me was the weird symmetry or between those sites and the sites that I'm so familiar with at home.
Yeah,
and how obviously they're completely different, obviously, but in another way that they're not. And
How weird did the locals think you were, being so fascinated with them?
We did get a lot of sort of frowny faces as to, you know, why we were wanting to go and find these things. And on every occasion, we ended up walking, you know, for a long time because, you know, public transport in Africa is, you know, it is what it is. And roads are not great. And so we would just be bumbling through the countryside trying to find these things. But they're well worth it, really well worth it.
So coming back closer to home then, because one of the comments that you made, that you've written about, was that having travelled so widely, you know, that you found that some of the best stories and the most beautiful sunsets were to be found right back there at home.
Yeah.
And so, you know, from that, coming back home, what was it that set you off on this, you know, on your blogging mission, really? And because you've travelled now, you know, you've written about a lot of sites, and I know you're not stopping at all.
It's a compulsion, you know, now.
Tell us a bit about that. You know, what was it? You came home and decided to start writing about Cornish sites, or how did that actually kick off?
So I came home, cutting a long story short, I did a lot of different jobs. You can imagine the prospects in Cornwall are quite limited work-wise. I worked doing antique restoration for a couple of years.
Wow.
And, then I got persuaded by my other half and by a friend of mine who's a photography lecturer to apply for a university degree. And the writing became more serious through that. I'd been writing bits and pieces for like village magazines and things like that, just odds and sods of things that just interested me. So it was already there. That was what I wanted to do, but I just didn't quite know how I was going to do that. And the blog really stems out of starting the degree. Becoming more familiar with technology, because, you know, that was not my strongest suit. I felt very fish out of water with all these like 20-year-olds.
I
can tell you a funny story that you might not necessarily include, but I turned up to one of my first journalism lectures with my Nokia phone, and the lecturer actually picked it up in front of the whole class and went, "What is this? You can't be a journalist with this." And I had to go out the next day and get a smartphone. All right, then. the blog stemmed out of the university degree and became a platform for me to write about what I wanted to write about, basically.
Yeah.
So Rupert said before, you write generally about Cornwall, but with a particular... I mean, you've got one menu at the top of your blog page, which is ancient monuments. And which was the first one that you wrote about, Lizzie?
I think it was Boscawen Nunn. I'm pretty sure it was Boscawen Nunn.
Which is a good place to start.
One of the first ones I visited as a teenager.
Yeah.
And always left a big impression on me.
Yeah.
It was actually... when I met my other half, our first date, let's say, was I took him out on a trip round the Penwith, how he stuck with me for 20 years. Heaven alone knows. But, you know, and that was one of the first places I took him. We went and had a picnic at Boscawen, which looked completely different then, in like the year 2000, than it does now. It was much more overgrown.
Which there's a group of there's people that look after it now, aren't there, that go every year and take away the hay, the grass, etc. Yeah, so it looks fairly manicured now. But I can only imagine. Gosh, it must have been difficult to find.
It was. It was. There weren't. It seemed to me that there weren't many people back in the day. You know, looking for these places. Obviously, places like Merry Maidens and Lanyon Coit were still. Or were very well known.
Was Boscawen associated with the Druidry back then, or is that? Yes, it was.
I remember being told at the time that it was used. It was a used circle.
Because they're an important order, aren't they? In the particular order in Cornwall.
I'm not familiar with them.
Was the Druidic order.
Yeah.
All right.
Yes, that centre around Boscawen Un, I think, I do believe. I should have looked up that before we started, because it's quite an interesting point. Early photographs of Boscawen Un tend to have quite a lot of druids amongst them.
I remember being told back in the late 90s that it was being used. But I never sort of got involved in that scene, I suppose. But there was often, and there still is often, little tokens left at the base of the leaning stone.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
I don't know if anything was there when you guys have visited, but there's often little pebbles and flowers.
I have an impression, I seem to remember, that one of the earliest places that you wrote about was the longest road. There's a track.
The oldest. The oldest road.
Yeah. Oh, did I say longest? Yes. No, I meant oldest. Yes. That would be silly.
That is one of my early ones. And that happened very coincidentally. It's a known as the Giant's Hedge. And I read about it somewhere, and as I often do on a day off, decided to get in my car and go and see. You know, if I could find it, and I
definitely the way you do,
And I found on a map, you know, this section of it that I thought that I might be able to access, you know, from the road, or you know, because there was no sort of real public footpath bit that I wanted to see. So I was driving around and trying to find it and this and that and going up and down. You know, you can imagine the very tight little lanes, you know, with the high hedges, and then I'm stopping, getting out of the car, trying to see where I was. And I pulled in to this sort of little lay-by. I had my map out, and I had a tap on the window. And so I wound my window down, and this real strong Cornish accent went...
In the middle of nowhere, you think you're alone.
You're never alone.
Yeah, the beginning.
And this guy, he went, if you're going down here, you're definitely lost. And I went, well, I'm hoping I'm not. And I explained to him what I was looking for, and he actually said he was the farmer that owned the land that, you know, had this section of the roadway on it. And he said, like, I've farmed here for however many years and no one has ever asked me where this thing is. And I was like, that sounds about right. And very fortunately for me, he was like, go ahead. You know, if you go up the road, you know, you'll see a gateway. And he said, there's some sheep in the field, but don't worry about those. And, you know, and he basically directed me to where I could find it. And it was the bizarrest place. I mean, you are in the field, and you reach the sort of bottom hedge of the field, and then it just dropped away, like a huge, great drop in the ground, because it's just so sunken.
Yeah,
it was incredible.
And we are talking prehistoric here when they say the oldest road.
It runs for about 10 miles from Lerin to Loo, and it's estimated to be about 4,000 years old. Which is incredible.
That's what I thought. I wasn't going to leap in, but No. Do you know what springs to mind is the fact that Cornwall is particular in that if you're a, you know, stone seeker or something, it's one of the few places that you can still go and seek out something obscure and have a really good adventure at the same time. meet the local farmers, for instance.
Exactly, yeah.
That
and I
kind
think
of
the,
place.
The one thing we have on our side as well is... despite what, you know, local media has been saying about Cornwall, we are a friendly lot. You know, we are very welcoming. And
have media
actually,
been saying otherwise?
We've only ever had good times in Cornwall. Well,
yeah.
There's been a lot of stuff recently about the fact that Cornwall hasn't been welcoming visitors during the coronavirus outbreak. But, you know, But that's besides the point. But I think that, you know, Cornish people, as a general rule, want to make sure that anyone that visits has a good time, and I think a fairly welcoming lot. And I think that the Cornish love anyone who is interested in Cornwall, if you know what I mean. 90% of Cornish people are incredibly passionate about where they're from, and anyone that takes an interest in their little patch of heaven, you know, they want to welcome them and make sure they have a good time.
Well, I think that's the important thing, you know, I've felt that people should understand about Cornwall, and your place in what the reason we're talking to you is that there are places off the beaten track. That you know the place and you're able to illustrate places that people would never get to see otherwise.
Yeah, and that was another driving force for me writing the blog as well, was to highlight those places, because I find that Cornwall tends to get the same few places highlighted by the press and by the tourist industry, you know, and everybody ends up going to the same beaches and the same attractions. The sort of underlying point is to highlight
I think we feel exactly the same about that. It doesn't matter where you go, that there's it's a bit like, you know, we've said, you know, for ages that, you know, out of all the sites there are across Britain, everybody knows Stonehenge, and that's, you know, for so many people that's it. But looking at Cornwall then as a whole, bearing in mind, you know, what we share is our desire to get prehistory out to a wider audience, to tell people about sites that they don't know and stuff like that. So for you, looking at Cornwall, what are your top places that you wish people knew more about, or you wish that they knew that they were there?
I see. I always get myself into trouble with these things because there are some people that go, "Why are you telling everybody? Stop it!"
Do
you know, we had that feeling doing Standing with Stones, actually. You know,
Really?
Sort of double-edged sword, slightly. Sorry, interrupted you there.
No,
Lizzie, I'm like, carry on.
So I do tend to get, you know, people that are a little bit tentative about advertising these places, but I can't see that there's going to be hordes of people, you know.
It's only the dedicated people that are prepared to put the walk in, you know. It's not the awful thing that some people
and battle
think,
with the brambles and the gorse and, you know, the stinging nettles and all of that. So I don't know. It's always really difficult for me to narrow down, you know, my favourite places to visit.
But you're going to, aren't you?
I will try for you. I don't know where to start, really. I suppose that a place that I wrote about quite recently, I don't know if you would have seen it, it was Droskin Point. I reshared that post on Twitter this morning because I suddenly thought I really enjoyed that day. And it was back in March, I think, February or March. And again, I was reading something and this popped up as like the oldest mine in Cornwall. And of course, I'm like, the what now? Where is this? So, you know, jump in the car and go and find it. And if you guys haven't read it, it's... sort of in a cliff face overhanging the sea near Perranporth, and there's these mining galleries which have basically been cut directly out of the cliff face to get the tin that was close to the surface then.
Yeah.
And they're thought to be about 2,000 years old, maybe a bit older than that. And I just think they're just amazing because you can go right up to that rock face and you can see the tool mark still in the stone after 2,000 years. And that to me is just incredible. I love that tangible connection to the people that were there before you.
But mining the tin for far further back than that. We were talking just last week about a particular stone circle in the south of Ireland on the Brera Peninsula, and they were mining stuff there to combine with Cornish tin to make your bronze. Really, really important.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously tin streaming went back further again than that, because it's so rich down here, you could literally pick it up off the surface. This was just the evidence where they were mining it intentionally from the cliff face. There's layers of history with that place, because after that it was used by smugglers during the 19th century to squirrel away their contraband. So that's one thing I enjoy finding out about these places, is the those different layers of history.
While we're touching on the subject of metals, what is the connection with the Nebra sky disk?
Oh, yes, yeah. That was, I can't remember if it was a newspaper article I read, but I was just sitting at home one evening with the other half, and I went, I've just read the most amazing thing, and told him about this Nebra sky disk. And he just said to me, well, let's go. And I was like, what? And he's like, well, do you want to see it? I was like, yeah. So we booked an easy jet flight to Berlin and took the train to Halle in Dessala. And it's in a little museum, like the little town museum.
Yeah.
But it is, if you haven't seen it, it is the most amazing object.
Yeah.
I mean, it's stunning. I was completely blown away, completely floored by it.
I've forgotten the date on it.
It's Bronze Age, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's 4,000 plus, I think.
Wow.
And the connection with Cornwall is the gold in the disc that was used to represent the stars, etc. Was actually, they've traced it somehow with their magical...
They have ways and means.
Yes.
...technology. And they've traced it right back to the Carnan Valley, which is just, a matter of miles from me, a couple of miles.
Oh, that is brilliant. Yeah.
And the tin in it as well was traced back to Cornwall, which I always find that incredible. I think we've spoken about it before, that movement of people and objects in that time period. We think of it all being as very sort of, I don't know if I'm going to use the right word, as backward is not what I want to say, but...
insular, maybe.
Insular is a better word.
Yeah. Isolated.
And of course, isolated. And of course, it wasn't at all,
No.
Yeah, it's true. Historically speaking, we know about the wealth of trade that was coming from the Romans coming into Cornwall for minerals. So there's absolutely no question that it extended back, quite a long way prior to that. And it's amazing, actually, when you look at things. Grimes Graves. Amongst all the flints and what have you, they found a greenstone axe there, beautiful polished greenstone axe that was from Cornwall. Yeah. So, clearly Cornwall has been making its mark from a trading and exchange point of view. Cornwall's been making its mark around the British Isles for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah.
And talking of trading and exchange, that kind of rings a bell for me, because there are more than one double or triple, even triple, stone circles on Bodmin Moor and elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously the hurlers.
I mean, I can only think of, I'm the triple one of the hurlers, but you know of more, Liz.
I don't know if, well, triple is debatable. There's a stone circle down on the Penwith Tregaseal.
Yeah.
That I've read somewhere that there could have been, well, there were definitely two and there might have been three stone circles there.
Yeah.
There's more pairs, there's more twin stone circles. So there's emblems on Arthur's Downs.
Yes.
There's twin there. And then there's Leskernick Hill, where there's two stone circles and a stone row.
Yeah.
And I was involved actually about 5 years ago in uncovering the stones at Leskernick, actually. I work with a team of mostly old gentlemen that we call ourselves...
I'm sure I don't know what you mean.
So they're the time seekers run by a chap called Roy, and they invited me to join them through a blog post that I wrote actually that Roy has read, and so I've been working with them on and off now for about 5 years I think, and they are a clearance team up on Bodmin Moor, and stones like Leskernick, all the stones are recumbent, so. Yeah. And the first time I tried to see Leskernick stone circles, I ended up wandering around the moor for a good 2 hours before giving up and going home. Because where they're marked on the old OS map is not quite right. And because they're all recumbent, there's no way of finding them.
Yeah.
So what we do as a clearance team is we go around and remove the turf from the stones. And it's all done... in cahoots with Cornwall Archaeological Unit and
I was going to say
English Heritage
sort of
and Natural England. And Natural England give us advice on how to we replace the turf into like the dips in the ground that the cattle make and things like that, just so that all the wildflowers and everything is looked after. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we the first job that I did with them was uncovering the two stone circles and the stone row. And the stone row I think I'm right in saying had been sort of lost, really. It had been sort of partially recorded, but then no one really had any record of exactly where it was. And we basically uncovered it.
It's really interesting.
It's an amazing site. Leskernick as a whole, there's a book about the site, Stone World.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing site because not only have you got the two circles in the stone row, you've also got cairns and you've got a propped stone. And then you've got numerous hut circles and field enclosures all
so
over.
A real complex. And it's interesting because I think the impression so many people get is that the sites are isolated and singular. But it's at sites like that you really get a sense of things going on, of busyness of some sort going on.
And a busyness for a very long period of time. For generations and generations of people.
Yeah.
No, I think that's something, you know, we should take on board next time we take a longer look at Cornwall or even come down. You know, try and emphasise that point
a bit more. We'll do that. We'll come down and we'll visit you and you can take us.
I would love that. That would be amazing. Yeah, I would love
absolutely.
That. I would be a happy bunny if I could plan a day where all I had to do was take you guys out and entertain you with the strange and wonderful sights of Cornwall.
Well, we'll make a point of doing that.
Fantastic. You don't know what you've let yourself in for.
I have to say that reading your blogs, I mean, it was actually a joy for me because you've written about sites that I have to say I'd never heard of them. And one of them in particular, Emblance, which I had not heard of Emblance, and quite intrigued by that because obviously, as you're just saying, albeit not about Emblance, but a lot going on. And one of the things that intrigued me there is that there's a stone there, one of the monoliths, that I haven't seen another stone exactly like that, albeit this is an awful lot shorter. But it's the same overall sort of shape as the stones up on Stennis, and I've never seen that. That's on Orkney, and I've never seen it anywhere else, where something looks as if it has so deliberately been chosen because of its shape.
There is a lot of that, I think, on Bodmin Moor. I've had discussions with Roy of the Time Seekers about this before. He has a theory about the stone circles on Bodmin Moor. And I'm fishing for it in my head a little bit, but there are a lot of what he calls tri-stones, so sort of triangular-shaped stones.
I see.
And he feels that these stones are particularly positioned facing Rau Tor, so that they are sort of mirroring the shape of that Tor within the circle.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. But it's a theory, yeah.
I noted, I think you're talking about some of the hut circles and some of the settlements there.
Yeah.
Sort of, you know, we come back to this wonderful thing of dating, that, you know, they have seemed to have been dated to the Bronze Age, which kind of makes sense because that's when all the activity probably was going on around extracting tin, etc. I'm just thinking back, Time Team went to Rau Tor and concentrated on the, I think it was the sort of northeast slope. There's a sort of hut circles and other enclosures down
and
there.
And the Long Cairn.
That's not far from the Long Cairn. And I think they got ecstatic about three quarters of the way through. Somebody found a piece of flint. I don't know, you're going to get a date from that, but they reckon that that pushed it back into the Neolithic.
Yeah.
So, you know, fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think we all, as we were saying about Les Koenig, you have to bear in mind that, you know, these things didn't just pop up one day
and then
people walked off and forgot about them the next day. You know, the ground was probably used by subsequent generations for probably a much longer time than we appreciate.
Actually, interestingly, you know, that you've been sort of painstakingly kind of avoided the places that people already know. So I can't recall seeing you writing a piece about the Hurlers, for example.
No,
you know,
I haven't.
Which is kind of in that vein,
well,
isn't
you know,
it?
You kind of you want to say things that other people aren't saying, don't you?
Yeah.
There's no point in going back over the same stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I do to a certain extent because I love to bring in sort of antiquarian writers, people, you know, like Borlase or you know, even people in the last sort of last 20 or 30 years. I like, when I'm writing about a place, to bring in as many different sources as I can, you know, to give sort of a wider picture of people's impressions of that place. But I don't want to be going over. There's no point in me writing about St. Michael's Mount, because it's, you know,
we couldn't agree more. It's about showing people stuff that they don't know about. That's the whole thing, isn't it?
And it's about the things that I discover as well. You know, obviously I'm born and bred here. I've lived the majority of my life in Cornwall, but I am always discovering new stuff. And when I started the blog, I thought there was a possibility that I would sort of run out of ideas. I would run out of things to write about. But quite clearly not, because, you know, new things pop up all the time. Like the cup muck stones that I was telling you about.
Oh, yes. Say more about those.
Yeah. So it was last autumn. I was researching something else and came across an archaeological report that mentioned these cup muck stones at Stithians. And I always think of this sort of central area of Cornwall, sort of the Redruth, Camborne, you know, Truro, Falmouth area, as being quite devoid of prehistoric remains. But I'm coming to realise, actually, with the more I learn, that that's probably that the case is that there was a lot more here. Mm. It's just been destroyed by the amount of industry that there was in this area. There was quite a large Logan Rock near me, near Constantine, mm-hmm. that was sort of blown up by the local quarry in about 1860. You know, it was kind of like, oops. You know? And there was also a standing stone, which was the biggest standing stone in Cornwall. Don't ask me how tall it was, I can't remember, but it was recorded as the largest. Oh, and it got broken up and made into about 20 different gateposts. Wow. Again, in the 19th 20? century. Yeah, wow. So it was ridiculously big. You can find it online. But so I'm always learning about different stuff that was around me. So when I read about these cup-marked stones in Stithians, I thought, I've never heard of this. So did a bit more digging and found out where they were supposed to be and just drove over there one afternoon. So there was a dam that was built at Stithians in the 1960s, and the dam covered about 300 acres of farmland in a shallow valley. And in the 1980s, we had a very dry summer, and a gentleman happened to just be part of Cornwall Archaeological Unit, a guy called, I think it was Don Cave. He was walking around the perimeter of the lake and just stumbled across these cup-marked stones that nobody knew existed. And what has sort of transpired since is that when the ground was flooded, they were in an area of land that had never been cultivated because it was really rocky. And it was the action of the water that uncovered these cup-marked stones. So without actually them being covered by the reservoir, we would never have known that they were there. They did some excavations sort of there in the 1980s and found an awful lot of flint. I think there's some pieces of axe heads found and these three areas of cut marked stones which are I think are amazing. I mean they're not the most impressive sight to see, you know. I don't know if you've seen any pictures of them, but they are, you know, slabs of rock with these round round holes cut in them.
But there are people out there that are serious about this stuff.
I know, and I'm one of them, you know. I get very excited about these things, and I just took myself off there with no expectation, actually, of finding them at all, because I knew that the water was supposed to be at a certain level and, you know, and I only had a vague idea and it's a big lake and I only had a vague idea about where they were, but I did find them. So, it was amazing.
Like I say, and Cornwall is still the kind of place where you can go and have that adventure of discovery where you're not quite sure whether you're going to get there or not. And the pleasure in finding a place that, you know, on the Ordnance Survey map looks a little bit obscure, you know, and you arrive at it, it said nine stones, and there are not nine stones, it's something else, you think you're in the wrong place. And you think, oh my goodness, I am lost. No, you're actually in the right place.
Yeah, that's a T-shirt we have worn many a time.
So you can still have that adventure. But you've also got this choice of landscape to do it in. You can do it in the, you know, in the wilds of Bodmin, or you can find yourself struggling through undergrowth and gorse, you know, finding somewhere like Boscawen Un or one of the other.
Or have beautiful views out to sea, like all that. Balmoral Barrow. It's a gorgeous county. It really is. And I think partly because it is, you know, you only go to Cornwall because you want to go to Cornwall. You're not driving through it to go anywhere else. and so it's one of the lovely aspects about many of the sites in Cornwall is that more than anywhere else, you're going to have them to yourself. So you do feel as if you've, you know, even if it's on the map, you know, you feel as if you've discovered something when you walk into these places. Yeah. It's so evocative and
I would suggest that people come out of season as well. I know that there's a huge risk in that because in Cornwall we do like the rain. I mean, we go in for all kinds of rain. But out of season, especially sort of autumn, early spring, you can still have some really lovely mild weather.
Oh, yeah.
And you've still got the longer days. and you haven't got the visitor numbers clogging up the roads in the same way.
And for people that haven't been to Cornwall, there is a particular quality of light down there that gives the landscape a certain luminescence, shall I say, something like that.
I used to say that you could sort of drop me down somewhere and I would know that it was a Cornish sky.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
Got it, exactly.
So go on then. What is your favourite site in the whole of the county?
That's just a mean question.
All right. We can put it another way. I don't know. Is there a site that you find yourself visiting slightly more than anywhere else?
Oh, that's an interesting way of putting it.
You'd have to look at the stats here.
Yeah. It depends where I... This is going to sound insane. Depends where I am. What I mean by that is it depends whether I'm down west or whether I'm up on Bodmin Moor. And that tends to be... I mean, Bodmin Moor is a good hour's drive for me, but I just love it up there. Mm-hmm. I love the wide open spaces and those big horizons.
Yeah.
And, you know, because I'm a slightly antisocial bugger, I like being on my own. Yeah. And, you know, I take a lot of pleasure in that. And picking one, it would be really difficult for me.
Well, kind of take that as an answer, actually, because there is a particular quality to Bodmin Moor, and the fact that if you go on to Bodmin Moor, that even if you don't know it, you're probably walking over any number.